What is up, everybody? Armand here, back with another episode. Today's guest, we have Riggs Eckelberry. Riggs is the founder of Origin Clear. They're a company that's set out to solve a trillion-dollar water crisis that nobody really talks about, and it has to do with the infrastructure of water today. So we get into that. It was really fascinating. I didn't even know this was a problem, but now that I hear it, it makes a lot of sense. Honestly, you should check it out. He started in the 80s getting into the tech scene. In the 90s, he was a part of companies in the dot-com bubble. And then from there, he started a cybersecurity company and then ultimately went into Origin Clear. It was really cool to hear his background. He's very experienced in entrepreneurship. He has an unusual workout routine, which was fun to hear. You should check that out. And then we go into skiing. So the workout routine helps him with skiing. He's a really cool dude to talk to. He's definitely an adventurer. Like he ventured off to be a ship captain at one point. Like he just has so many cool stories. We also talk a little bit, he keeps up with the news a lot. So he's talking a little bit about Elon's Twitter strategy and how to view news and media in an unbiased way. So he has some really good tips on keeping an open mind and just taking bits and pieces from everything. Be sure to listen to the whole episode this time. We talk a lot in the closing questions. We actually have like some really good conversation there. So yeah, hope you enjoy this episode of the Play Hard Podcast.
Work hard, play hard, work hard, play hard, work hard, play hard, work hard, play hard.
Oh,
there we go.
Yeah, baby. Now there we're talking. Go.
All right.
All right. Good job.
Perfect. All right. Riggs, how's it going? How's your day been?
Wow. I'm amazed it's only Tuesday. Lord have mercy.
That's funny. Actually, my dad last week, he told me he woke up on Monday thinking it was Friday. And I was like, sometimes those are the kind of weeks you have.
Well, it's actually good because usually the weeks, you know, we're doing so much right now that, you know, packing it all in is a challenge. So I'm like, something happened. All of a sudden, more time in the week. I'm going with that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all the mindset, really. So you're right. The CEO and one of the founders of Origin Clear. Did I read correctly that you co-founded this with your brother?
Correct, but way back in the day, in fact, it was called Origin Oil because our mission in the early days was to turn algae, microalgae, into biofuels, and which was cool. So much fun, and I was on all the mainstream media. But then fracking came in and dropped the price of crude way below $50. At that point, it was like a science experiment, and we had to figure out what we were going to do instead. Fortunately, our technology could be repurposed to clean water. So we did a pivot, and we ended up in the water industry, which was fascinating because, you know, water is largely a government monopoly, but it's underserved, it's way underfunded. Since 1961, we've accumulated a $1 trillion unmet deficit of infrastructure, and no one's going to write that check anytime soon.
Yeah.
And so we stepped into a space that was invisible to the public because governmental, but also badly underserved. And with all these problems cropping up, you know, like Flint, Michigan, like Compton, California, Jackson, Mississippi, and nobody knowing what to really do about it. I literally talked to a friend who was in the Mississippi House of Representatives in Jackson, Mississippi, saying, hey, there's a problem with the water. And he says, oh, that's the city, that's not me. So literally, there's this sort of hands-off view.
Yeah.
And so there's a solution. I can talk about it. But the point is that we stepped into a world that was had very little awareness and yet is crucial to our health and existence.
Yeah, I saw someone was kind of mentioning a post the other day that you could go, you know, the classic saying, 2 to 3 weeks without food, but only 3 days without water. It makes up most of who we are. And it's so, not just for like, it's what, it keeps you healthy. Like the more water you drink, the better you feel throughout the day, your energy levels. So how is it that such a, you know, essential aspect to being human, water, is so kind of like almost turned a blind eye. It seems like no one's taking responsibility for this kind of issue. Like, how did the infrastructure get this bad?
That's a very good point. We had, of course, a boom in building water systems in the 19th century, the wonderful New York, the Delaware distribution system, which is amazing to this day. And then into the 20th century, right into World War II, you know, like, for example, look at Hoover Dam, right? That was a huge project. But what it took was, you know, they were okay with the occasional worker falling in the concrete and dying and being buried with the concrete. You could never do that today. And so, in a way, I don't know if you've been in Los Angeles, Armand, but there's all these huge concrete rivers that today we would never build those. It's not the way. And so there's an antiquated way of building giant public works systems that is not feasible today. And so what happened is we didn't realize it. And so starting in the 60s, the impetus to build more of these and to keep doing more just wasn't there. I don't think that politicians respond to what people's concerns are. And if people aren't screaming about water, the politicians will do something else. So the, for example, the Biden administration did this huge infrastructure bill a couple years ago, $1.2 trillion. The water part of it was $55 billion, which is less than 1 year's unmet budget for the infrastructure. But we funded rural broadband. You know, well, I think water is more important than rural broadband. As important as rural broadband is, you know, I think that water is more vital to life. Now we're seeing what's going on in East Palestine, Ohio, which is affecting the entire Ohio River watershed.
That's right. Yeah,
that's a big deal. One of my execs is based outside of Pittsburgh, and he's literally two counties away from a county that is seeing dying wildlife.
Wow.
It brings it home. It's horrendous, right?
Yeah. So, just to let you know, I am located in San Diego, so I know exactly what you're talking about in LA. It's, I know what you're talking about, because you see videos like of people skateboarding and stuff there now. Like, that's what it's for. No, it's not really, well, lately we've been getting a lot of rain, so I'm guessing it's going to be a little more useful, but I don't know. It's a fascinating problem.
On that thought, they were built to get the water as fast as possible into the ocean. Wait, hold your horses. We need that water. The Army Corps of Engineers, their job was, okay, a flood's going to come along. We got to channel it. We got to get it to the ocean. And it does a fine job of that. And you're right. Those rivers are actually full for once. I'm seeing videos of, like, literally storm-tossed river. But here's the thing. And in fact, there was a LA River project that was started by Mayor Garcetti to change the river to an absorption model so that it recharges the groundwater. And that is the smart way to go. The problem is that the infrastructure is old. America's infrastructure is generally treat it and dispose of it, whether it's the floodwaters going into the ocean or the sewage being treated and put in the ocean. That's the model, but we have to reuse the water. We have to save the water. We're draining our aquifers, and it takes hundreds of years to recharge an aquifer once it gets depleted. The estimate for the Ogallala Aquifer, for example, in the Midwest, which is being depleted, is that once it's depleted, it takes 600 years to recharge it, and you can't just pump. It has to happen on a sort of seepage basis. So what we have to move to is a new model. Now, here's the good news. Remember how in Africa they bypassed the whole landlines thing and they went straight to cell phones, which is current technology. Meanwhile, America was stuck with its landline stuff and cell phone adoption was slower as a result. Well, we have a chance to leapfrog to this new model, which is very light and adaptable and localized and very heavy on the reuse. And as a result, we will have the number one infrastructure in the world, and it will not take $1 trillion. That's the vision, and it's in part because the government monopoly is breaking up, and it's being commercialized. You know, when AT&T got broken up, it turned into eventually what became the internet. It was huge, and I think the same thing will happen with water.
And what is Origin Clear's kind of piece in this puzzle for solving that problem?
Right. So Origin Clear, I came out of high tech, and one of the things we have in high tech is these incubators. Y Combinator, Idealab, Bill Gross's Idealab in Pasadena for many years was a great model. They don't exist in water. In water, you build a mom-and-pop water company, and then you, when you just time to retire, you sell it to the big guys, and that's it. But the problem there is that there's a lot of water technology that is not finding funding because that's not a mom-and-pop model. When you technology is not built on the mom-and-pop basis, it's built on a more of a VC model, and it just doesn't exist in water. So we decided we would be the first water incubator, and that's what we are. And we have created our first child, so to speak, which is this amazing thing called Water on Demand. And here's what we realized. There's two things. Let's just fast forward to what the solution is to our infrastructure problem. It's not going to be building billion-dollar central systems. Not going to happen. Even if you had the money, where are you going to locate it? I'm in Pinellas County in Florida, and it's full of houses. And no one wants a sewage plant next to their home. So it's not going to happen. The solution then is to co-locate the water treatment at the businesses that are making the water dirty, right? And
that,
in fact,
that makes sense.
Right? 90% of all freshwater demand is by industry and agriculture. So if we unburden the system and have them do the heavy lifting of their own water, there's two benefits. Number one, it unburdens the central system, and that way humans, us, you and me, we're the remaining 10%. We can get proper service from these cities.
Yeah.
And because right now they can't. They're being completely overloaded by all the industrial waste and agricultural waste. Secondly, once these businesses do their own treatment, they can recycle themselves. They can reuse it. They have an economic incentive to do so because they don't have to pay for the water again. And so now we start implementing recycling in this country for the first time.
So it would also be
basically don't do.
It'll also be kind of over time or in a way, if they're treating their own water, it'll turn it kind of cheaper almost.
Exactly. So the businesses, when they hear that they can get off the municipality system and onto their own, they like it because they don't get quite as much regulatory hassle. Number two, they get a stable water rate. Water rates have been skyrocketing much faster than inflation in this country. So this way, it locks in a certain inflation index on a long-term contract. Number three, they can recycle, therefore get more turns out of the water, which is financially good. And then we have a combination of, number one, the technology to downsize down to these businesses, called modular water, and then we have the finance system to enable these businesses to continue paying on the meter and not have to come up with $1 million that they don't have.
Yeah.
And that's called water on demand.
Interesting. Yeah, it sounds like the, at the very least, the fair thing to do if 90% is, businesses and agriculture are using this water and then they're not even taking care of their, like, it's, you kind of seem like that would be the right thing to do. Why is it that we haven't moved towards that direction yet?
I think, again, it's because of neglect. Our water systems were designed originally to serve humans. In the early industrial days, it wasn't as intense as it is today. But now we have factory farming. So these intense factory operations, for example, in the Carolinas, put out huge amount of nitrates. And look, I'm a businessman. I'm going to do what the law requires me. And even then, I'll try and get a lawyer to help me sort of put off the inevitable, right? So you can't really blame corporations. But when you come up with a better idea for them, generally they go, oh, okay, that makes sense for my bottom line. And that's what we're finding. So we're finding, a lot of adoption for what I call radical decentralization. This is a new concept where we immediately get businesses off of the municipal system through this sort of drop-in-place technology. And then the other part of it is to help them financially, so they don't have to buy the system and they just pay it by the gallon, which they love as well. Those two things work in synergy to make it easy for the businesses to do it and we've got more business than we can possibly handle. It's ridiculous.
That's good. Yeah, that's great to hear. How did you get into this entrepreneurial journey in the first place? Like, taking a step back on the entrepreneurship story, I know you started before this a cybersecurity company. I believe you were doing some other things too. So how did this kind of come about?
Very good question. Well, I was raised as a corporate brat in various capitals of the world. My dad was a Procter & Gamble exec, and he'd sort of go to the next branch office kind of thing. And he was literally like John Hamm in Mad Men. He was that guy.
That's cool.
With all the pluses and minuses. Yeah. Really interesting guy. And so he was very much like, you know, in the 50s and 60s in Europe, if you were an American with dollars, you were in good shape. He could talk, he could meet and talk with anyone that he wanted to anywhere, really. He was top of the heap. And he kind of communicated that point of view of like, hey, you have access. You can see and talk to anyone you want. Then what I did was I actually got really excited about working in the nonprofit space. And so coming out of high school, I literally went straight into the nonprofit and learned a lot of great things. For example, I became a ship captain and had a whole side career on that. That was fascinating.
Yeah, a whole adventure at sea.
Oh, it was amazing. The stories, we could do a whole other podcast on those stories. but I also got a sense of doing, you know, not just doing a 9-to-5, doing something good for the world that, you know, I was being paid literally nothing, but I was having really a good time being focused on making things better in the world. Well, eventually, I wrapped that up in the early 80s, and I started looking at what was transformational in a similar way out in the business world, and it was clear to me it was technology. That's it, right? And so I just don't think as an employee, right? So instead, I just jumped straight in the boiling water, and I started a company in Manhattan in the 80s, which was at a wonderful time, but it was I was always undercapitalized, and eventually this is a really good learning experience for me that I've taken heart with, which is that I basically got discouraged, and I gave the business to my best salesman, and he's since become a millionaire with it, and I moved on, which from a financial point of view, I probably should have stuck with what I was doing. But from a skills point of view, it got me eventually into the .com. Mm-hmm. I eventually ended up in LA in the early 90s, and I was in the early days of the .com, and I had a blast. I loved the use of computers moved from computing, which is what I was doing in the 80s with these business computer systems, to communication. And computers for communication, of course, blossomed. It's what you and I are doing right now, right? And so that, I became passionate about it, and I had some good experiences. I had, some liquidity events, as we call it, which was very nice. And got to the year 2000, helped a company called yellowpages.com survive the year 2000 and get sold to a couple of Baby Bells. That was a win. And then I had a chance to, I was busy, all through this period, the 90s and the early 2000s, going up the corporate ladder, and I finally got a chance to become a number two at a company that was aiming to get onto the NASDAQ. And in fact, we succeeded. We got the company on the NASDAQ. And like all number twos, I thought I could be a better number one. And so I called up a fund that I was working with, that I'd worked with before, and I said, I'd like to be a CEO. And unfortunately, they agreed. And so they said, well, Riggs, we think you'd be a good CEO, but we're not doing tech anymore. We're doing green. And this is 2007, which was the height of the green era.
Yeah.
When, green was really big. And in fact, the administration at the time was working hard to keep the price of crude high to encourage renewables, which they eventually failed at. Eventually, the price went down to market. But they said, we think algae's got a future. We want you to head it and go find a technology. And I said, well, guys, I've got a technology. Long story short, we launched. And it's been 14 years of being a public company in these various iterations. And one thing I've learned is never get discouraged.
And how has that been, being a public company? Like, how's the whole journey? I don't know if I've talked to someone who's gotten on that side. I've talked to a lot of startup entrepreneurs, a lot of people who've sold off, like sold their companies or been bought out. But I don't know if I've gotten the chance to have a conversation with someone who took it public.
Well, it's I like it a lot because your only boss is the investing public. That's who your boss is, right? I mean, yeah, you're working for the board, but generally the board is you know, if you're doing the right thing, they'll just go along with it. But the investing public wants to know you're doing the right thing, and so that's really your boss. I like it. I like relating. We have some amazing investors in Origin Clear. They are super supportive. You know, we are working hard to, as I say, launch these companies into the stratosphere, and they're on board with it. So yes, there are requirements. You have to be audited. You have to a lot of disclosure. But I've gotten used to that by now. And everything I say now, you know, I don't say, you know, I will go to breakfast. I'll go, I am planning to go to breakfast, because everything is plan, intend, expect. It's never a straight statement. It becomes part of your lingo, you know. But personally, I like it. The one issue is that over the 14 years I've been doing this, the over-the-counter market, the penny stock market, has become more and more dysfunctional because there's been a lot of abuse. And really, the only game in town is to uplist to the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange, or some other large exchange like the German one or the Singaporean. There's a number of good exchanges out there, because investors have more, institutional investors have confidence that if you've made the requirements of NASDAQ, then you're okay. You know, you're investable. So if I had to do it again, I would do what's called there's a special kind of offering that came up in 2013, which is called Regulation A, unaccredited investors. And you can raise money through unaccredited investors, and built into that regulation is you automatically become public. And if you do it right, you're public on the NASDAQ. So that's the new thing, is to crowdfund your way to the NASDAQ. It's really, really interesting way to go. And in fact, we're just about to open a crowdfunding for our latest child, Water on Demand. And that is the secret sauce to get it on the NASDAQ.
Nice. Yeah, so you guys are learning, like, don't get discouraged. You know, you're passing along your learnings to the companies you're working with. And I think that's great. So I like how you said it's kind of like you're planning on going to breakfast. You're intending, like, that's kind of how your days go. To go on the topic of routines and your habits, like, what, I guess with you, like, what is the ideal? Do you have a set routine, or like, what's your ideal morning look like versus how does it actually look like?
Well, of course, long before COVID, I started operating from the home office. And the main reason was I'd show up at the office and people would go, oh, hey, Riggs. I get these people buttonholing me constantly. And in order to actually create hierarchy, I started operating from the home and it started working really well. And then, of course, COVID accelerated all that. And so I'm kind of on, I have a rhythm whereby I'm basically on duty all the time. But I take breaks. I'll I make sure I work out. Oh, so important. And you know, I have a particular workout that I'm very unusual, but nonetheless, it works for me. And then what I basically make sure is that it's a high stress position. So how do you keep from being stressed? Well, like I say, you work out, but also you learn to do things that change change the pace, right? For example, I'll help my wife with her school, or I'll work on a personal project. I continue to be involved with the nonprofit I was with way back in the day, and I'll do projects with them.
Yeah,
I continue to learn. I try to study something important every single day. I try to pursue spiritual health. All these things are built in so that I can kind of roll with it, and I can respond to something at 10 p.m. without, you know, being stressed about it. And you know, the people that who work for me who are stressed, they go, "Riggs, how do you do it?" I'm like, "Well, it's basically, you know, you just got to wave topping, boom, 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 boom. Don't go into the trough, right? Just stay on top of it." And one thing I've learned is that it's very easy to be the only responsible person in the room, and everybody else like, "Weak, weak, weak." It wants to be, "You're the responsible one. Help us," you know, Obi-Wan Kenobi. No. What you're trying to do, of course, is create an entourage of people who are as responsible as you. And it finally started happening. It took a few years, actually. But starting in 2018, I started getting really strong people around me that I don't have to go, "Hey, did you do this? Did you handle that?" I don't have to be the reminder service.
Yeah.
Which is really wearing, that's the most wear and tear, is when you, like, you go, "Oh, cripes, I have to now write the copy for this whole website. Kill me now." Whereas now I've got some good content people, and I'll just, I'll work more on the high level messaging, and that's
kinda
how
like
it should
be. The
feeling
you want to convey versus the actual message itself.
Yeah, like what are we trying to, you know, what is the high concept, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I, as long as I don't have to go, you know, like literally write every word, then I feel that my mental health is going to be okay because I'm being the communicator. My head is clear for it, but frequently my best work is done on the weekends, and I'm okay with that. It's fine.
Yeah. Well, and what, so what it's kind of sounds like is for the routine side, you keep things fluid. Like you have things that you do to improve your life in general, but you don't have to do it at this time of this day. Cause that's not going to happen. You're going to have things pop up at any given time, but let's say you just still want to get your workouts in and stuff like that.
Yeah. And the other big thing is not to have too many phone calls. Phone calls are terrible. First of all, there's no memory. You did a phone call and I'll go, "Was this handled? Well, 3 months ago we discussed this." I'm like, "So where was the memo?" So we try and have written, you know, we're heavy users of course, I have every freaking platform. I've got Signal, I've got Telegram, I've got WhatsApp, I've got iMessage. But whatever platform we use, there's constant chats going on there.
Yeah.
And then we use email our email, God forbid you should get it on one of our group lists because you'll start, we almost handle it like a chat and people get overwhelmed. But this is how we keep the conversation going and everybody in the loop.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, really important.
Yeah, I think that I never really thought of that. But as you mentioned it, yeah, there's been a lot of calls where if I'm not, like I like to write, I have a notebook, physical notebook, and I like to write, if something's an action item, I'll like do something to make it known to me. So when I look back during the day, I'm like, okay, that's something I got to take care of. Phone calls, I don't really get that. I'm not really sitting with my notepad every time I'm on the phone. Sometimes I'm driving, sometimes maybe I'm on a walk. And yeah, that's a really great point. If I don't take care of it right then and there, at the very least to write a to-do for myself, I'm going to hands down forget. You mentioned an unusual workout. I'm curious, what is that?
So, I don't know if you've heard of the bar method.
No, I haven't. How do you spell it?
B-A-R. Well, it was developed from the ballet warm up. And so what ballet dancers use to warm up with is turned into routine and there's offshoots called bar, B-A-R-R-E. And the reason it's unusual is I'm always the only guy in the room. And I've done over 900 of these workouts since I started, you know, 10 years ago. And I love it. It's you know, it gives me great core. It's wonderful for my skiing, you know, because I'd love to ski every day, but unfortunately I can't. So this keeps me in shape for it. And also, you know, the stretching after every strength exercise, which you want the stretching, and we tend to forget that part, right? So bar method for me, BAR method, you know, it's the bomb. I love it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I was actually just talking today on how I need to start stretching more. Might have to give the bar method a try. So you mentioned also skiing, and we talked about this a little bit before the show, but that's one of the big things that you like to do. You, and I quote, said you're a maniac skier. How long have you been skiing? What are your favorite mountains? Like, I want to hear the lowdown on this.
Well, are you a skier or boarder yourself?
I can snowboard. It's not something I frequently do.
Okay. So sorry, I need the feel for what kind of, yeah, you know, on the scale, where you are on the spectrum.
Very, very rookie. Very rookie.
Very cool. Well, of course, again, I was privileged growing up with, you know, at the age of five, I was already skiing at a resort in France. And we spent years and years and years skiing at a place in Austria called Kitzbühel. Wonderful times. I mean, to this day, I remember the whole family rushing through Paris to get to the station that, you know, Paris has a system where they have radial train stations. And so you go to a specific station to go to a specific part of Europe. And this is the Gare de l'Est, which is the eastern, the one that serves the east. Get in that train. And of course, it's a six bunk compartment. Being large family, we filled it all. And we'd fall asleep, wake up in the snow. How cool was that?
Yeah.
It was the best. And so I had great memories about that. And so I skied for many years as a young man, but eventually, you know, I started going to sea, which I love too. I love the ocean. And it wasn't until the 80s came around again that I started skiing first around the New York City area, which is called really ice skating, vertical ice skating, really.
Yeah.
And then
different
at the
style.
End of that. Oh my God. At the end of that decade, I started skiing in the West, and that was a revelation. And literally so much revelation that one day I was actually going through a phase of marketing a wine importing business, and I decided that, you know, I've never ski bummed and I need to ski bum. And my girlfriend promptly said, well, you can go do that. I'm staying in Rhinebeck, New York. And I went in and had my 40th birthday working as a cook at a 5-star restaurant in Keystone, Colorado. I had the best year of my life. It was the best. And that really, like, okay, I feel I've really gotten my fix. Then eventually had a son, and he and I skied since he was not even 1 year old. He was on my back, and then from 1 year old onward, he was, you know, on the leash and all that stuff.
Yeah.
We skied together all these years. And we'd get a lot of, because one thing about at the time we're living in LA is you can go to Mammoth in 4.5 hours. We were getting in 30 days a year of skiing. It was fantastic. Right. Not so easy from Florida, but we try.
True. Yeah. I didn't even think of that.
Right. Now, eventually he went into the workforce and he's working in the nonprofit space as well, which I'm so super proud of. But and we get to ski, but not as often. What changed for me was from being interested in skiing just as enjoying skiing to, you know, paying it forward. And my wife has a small, very individualized educational program, only a dozen kids at a time. And one of the things we do is we take the kids on a school trip skiing once a year. And then I teach them. I'm the crazy guy who takes them into the trees. And there's nothing a kid likes more than to do adventurous things and end up in a
yeah,
forest somewhere and stuck in a tree well or something. It's perfect. And then here's what's crazy is that not only do we have the school trip, but then the kids who graduated our program still wanted to go on a school trip. So we have a second trip. Literally next week I'll be in Utah with them, with the kids who are no longer in the program, but they insisted on continuing to ski and have fun.
Yeah.
So it's given me this feeling of, you know, mentoring. I love it. And I think that it's natural to move from a selfish love of the sport, which is an amazing sport. It's so invigorating and, you know, big skies and you're defying gravity, all this good stuff. But to actually pass it on, and I love that.
Yeah, that's you, Riggs. You strike me as an adventurer type, as someone who just likes to go out and just see where the wind takes you. I mean, you just left to be a cook in Colorado, 5-star restaurant, of course. You were a ship captain. Do you have any other kind of memories or stories of a time like that where you just said goodbye to everything for a short period of time?
Well, like everyone in LA, I worked for a year in film, right?
Yeah, of course.
Of course. Cool.
Either film or music, something.
Exactly, right? Because I've got a brother. It's good to have a big family, so I've got 5 brothers, and so one of them is, to this day, in film and a very good editor and director. And I was like, I want to do film. And this was at the period after I had given away my New York business, and I was doing all these different things, including eventually the wine thing and this and that. But what I really wanted to taste this filmmaking thing, and I got involved. I loved it, but I tell you, I have never worked as hard in my life as on film. These people have brutal schedules. Oh my gosh. I worked on an American Airlines commercial, and we shot enough 35 millimeter film for an entire feature film, 135,000 feet of film, for a 60-second commercial.
Wow.
We went to London, and we went to Paris, we went to Nice, and you know, it was one of those American Airlines commercials with the plane shadow flying over.
Yeah. Oh, so they had to get it just right, the timing, I'm guessing, they had to get, yeah.
Right. Well, it was one of these multi, so like, you're in Italy, you're here, here, you know, flashes. Well, each of these flashes, I was the production manager, and I got so that, you know, I was never sleeping. The only drug I wanted was sleep. It was like 6 weeks of, you know, 4 or 5 hours a night, it was insane. But at the end of the day, you have something pretty cool, right? So I love that. It's just that the problem is that for me, technology was a magnet. Eventually, I fell back. I was trying to do other things than technology. And eventually, I'm made for it. And I think the reason is that you can disrupt so much with technology. It is such a lever. Like we talk about climate change. Like climate change is not going to be fixed by, making farms have less nitrogen, whatever. No, it's going to be done with technology. Technology, I'm very much a fan of Elon Musk, of course, because he understands that we need to have technology disruption. And so I love changing things with fundamental technology breakthroughs. And that's finally what I'm privileged to do with this Origin Clear company. So much fun.
Yeah, I've always said Elon's kind of like the Michael Jordan of entrepreneurship, to have done so many companies. Currently, I don't know, I think he's like CEO of 4 different companies, maybe 5, I don't know, I can't count what he's doing. But he's doing so much, all very disruptive technologies in very interesting spaces. And it's just very impressive to see how one guy can be, you know, CEO of all of that, like how he can manage and juggle all those different roles.
He's amazing. He's like, and Steve Jobs is another guy like that too. I mean, these people, I think they know how to compress time. You know, you've heard about Jobs time, that literally
his the company's distortion field.
Yeah, exactly. And it is very true that a good CEO will bring about this can-do thing about, you know, deadlines and things you got to get done and getting people to just start, you know, really speeding up. And it's something that I study a lot in terms of what I watch Elon Musk go through. I watched very closely what he did with Twitter. And it's a combination of changing the culture very visibly from a communication strategy, as well as getting into the code and fixing the organization itself, both. And you're not supposed to be a CEO of more than one company, but he pulls it off.
Yeah. It's almost as if it goes against what Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, well, I don't know if he's not focusing, but how Bill Gates and Warren Buffett famously had that encounter together, and they both said focus is the most important thing. I guess I misattribute sometimes focus to only do one thing, because I've always been someone who like handles many different projects. But I think what it is if you can focus on the task at hand or what's important, what you need to move the ball for that day, then that's mm-hmm. important. But if you're just kind of like, I don't know, 1 foot in, 1 foot out every day for all your projects, you're not really going to do much.
Well, his focus, I think, is on, he is really about inventing a future we can live with. And that's his focus, right? His, you know, his goal for Twitter, for example, really is that he wants to have a proper marketplace of ideas and with a minimum of restraint. And that's more workable, in my opinion, than this heavy-handed censorship mode that started to, you know, that sort of grew almost unrestrained. And that's why he's also, you know, I drive a Tesla, and my the UX, the user experience of being in a Tesla is amazing. You know, I park my car and I press a button that keeps it cold while I'm going in there and doing whatever. Right? How cool is that?
That is pretty nuts.
That's great. Yeah. I don't have to worry about the groceries getting warm. It's like, it's all good. It's all good.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, that is pretty nuts. I didn't even think of that. Well, Riggs, with that, I just have a couple closing questions, something to get to know you a little better, and then we can wrap this interview up. Let's get into it. Number one, what kind of music do you listen to?
That's a really good question. I have to say that I like all kinds of questions. For many years, I liked house music and it really depends if I'm trying to work or if I'm listening, right? Mm. So for work, you want more of the Euro kind of dub or house type music, stuff like that, which doesn't distract you too much. I've noticed, for example, that Spotify does a great job of grabbing stuff for me that is kind of a good groove, and I'm listening to performers. I would say that, you know, present day, what we used to think of as alt rock today is more of a like an esoteric global pop kind of music. It weaves a lot of cultures together. It's got vocals, but it's also very often very mesmerizing. I like that kind of music. Mm-hmm. That's in general, I think of music as something that puts me in a certain frame of mind and makes me think of interesting things, and that is usually current fusion, you know, jazz, pop, rock type music.
Yeah. I like that. Puts you in a certain state of mind. I think that's that right there, I'd say, is the key to intentionally listening to music. Sometimes we just have it in the background. Maybe you are studying or doing work, and other times it's like you want to listen to something for the feeling it brings. At least that's something I like about music.
Yes.
So what kind of movies or TV shows do you like? Anything you would recommend to the audience out there?
Well, I have to say that my wife and I have totally different tastes. Currently, we're watching Sanditon, which is a great little series that, I like period pieces because it's fascinating, you know. But my own druthers is I get very geeky. For example, I watched the Ancient Apocalypse series on Netflix.
Yeah.
Which was fascinating. Like, okay, the whole idea that there was a reboot of civilization post this calamity called the Younger Dryas was, to me, fascinating. There is also, I got into an anime saga, Vinland Saga. Was a manga series that I don't know if they've gotten into a second, but Vinland Saga. It's about really the period when they were just getting to know the North American continent, and they were starting to trade back and forth. And it's this whole world. In general, I love historical fiction, and You know, I thought that was a super cool show. But, you know, frankly, I have to tell you, Armand, I read, mostly read. I read, 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 read. And I read everything from, you know, the other day I read through War and Peace, and then I'll do science fiction and fantasy, and then I'll do some historical novel. I'm just omnivorous when it comes to reading. And I think it just gets me outside of my workspace. It makes me more, I open my antennas better if I just read any kind of wacky thing. I find myself reading a young adult book. I'm like, what am I doing? But it's just stuff that just gets me out there. And that way I don't have this obsessed narrow focus in my life, which is
Get that. I mean, you did a great job. I mean, my third question was going to be, what books are you reading right now? So you check that one off. But no, I feel like, so something I do is I play music. I play bass in a band, and I was asking someone who is much more experienced than me, like, how do I improve my playing? Like, how do I become a better bassist? And he said, listen to the most random and different types of music and just try to pick apart, like, the pieces you like in that music. But I think the same could go for reading or so many different, like, I think what he was just saying is keep an open mind with this art form, but it could go with reading as open mind with your thinking, because a lot of it's like the kind of content we consume is kind of the stuff we think about. If we're just in this vacuum chamber of reading and watching videos of all the same stuff we already know and listen to, you're not really going to be learning much. You're just going to be confirming everything there.
Yeah, and you know, every Thursday night I do a CEO briefing. We just did this weekend, day after tomorrow, we'll have our 200th episode. And in order for it to be interesting to people, it helps for me to have my tentacles out there. And so I subscribe to a bunch of these Telegram channels that are sometimes way out there. But what I'll get out of it is I'll get nuggets that relate to the economy and sometimes to water itself. And it informs my briefing to my audience that I've got, hey, guess what? There was this interesting thing that happened with the cost of, you know, eggs, which was a recent thing, right? Eggs took off. So, you know, by scanning through what is mostly incredibly wild stuff, I get the occasional nugget that I can reuse. And I think that's important too. You've got, you know, it's very important not to be doctrinaire, right? I am the left, I am the right, I am this, I am that.
Yeah.
Because there's truth woven through all of these viewpoints. And so if you just keep a really good outlook on all the media channels, and then you can just pick what you want. And there's, you know, that was BS. I get that. That's BS.
Yeah.
But you get the good stuff.
How do you sort between the BS and truth when... Because it sounds like right now what you're doing is trying to take in the world in an unbiased lens. And a lot of these channels tend to have a certain bias. And some truth is woven in with some bullshit. Like, how do you weave... Or how do you sort through all of that?
Well, it's a hard... You're right. It's hard. But I think after a while... There is a bullshit meter, right? After a while, you go, yeah, that's just somebody pushing an agenda, right or left, whatever, right? This,
yeah,
and then of course, there's always commercial angle behind these things too. But when, for example, I see the producer price index in Germany just skyrocket, well, that's a fact, that's a stat, right?
Yes,
it's an actual thing. Now, what somebody's opinion of it is another thing, but I can take that and go, okay, here's what's going on in Germany with the producer price index. What does that mean for the Germans? And what does it mean for... I'm a big fan of Peter Zeihan. I don't know if you've heard of him. He is a geopolitical speaker. And his book, The End of the World is Just Beginning, I think is what it's called. And what he means by that is we're in a deglobalization process where we're going to go back to regional. And he has very strong opinion about the North American region being a future... very powerful, we'll go through a very powerful renaissance as we bring back manufacturing to America.
Yes.
The next 20, 25 years are going to be a huge boom, and it'll be fresh tech. All these factories that will be built will have the robots, the AI, the high-speed computing, all that stuff built in. And we'll, of course, And why was that important to me? Because this can be so fast, we'll have to co-locate the water facilities with those businesses.
Mm,
and that gives us our strategy. Exactly.
Yeah.
So that informed me tremendously. When I listened to Peter Zeihan being interviewed on Joe Rogan, he freaked out Joe Rogan because a lot of it was quote-unquote bad news, but there was good news in it about our, you know, access to Mexico, which is a wonderful labor pool, educated, et cetera. And we just have a great future. And so out of that, I extracted strategy. And that's what you got to do in the end is, how does this make sense for what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis?
Okay. So it sounds like what kind of how to sort and filter through all of this and then turn it into something that you can use for a strategy would be, number one, you take an objective stat, such as egg prices are going up. And then you get curious about that and you try and find out from different types and different pools of resources, why is that? Because I feel like a lot of different people are going to have their point fingers somewhere else and whatnot. But like you start to see a common thread. You start to pull some truth from all that, and then you can use that into your advantage somehow.
100%. And, you know, there is such a thing as trusted media figures. I think Joe Rogan in the main, I disagree with him on, but he in the main is a very dispassionate listener.
Yeah.
I like people who, like you, who listen, right? That way, they're less likely to have a bias because they're listening. They're not talking, right? And he does a great job of listening. I've had a lot of fun, sorting through his stuff. And I strongly recommend Peter Zeihan to you. The Joe Rogan interview, you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, I'll check it out. And I appreciate that. I've actually been working on a book on active listening. And what I've noticed is one of the most important... So the first section is just the mindsets that a lot of strong listeners I've noticed have. And one of the most important ones really is coming without, even if you have to suspend your biases or everyone's got their judgments, but when listening to someone, coming in judgmentally it doesn't serve the listening purpose. Like if your goal is to understand that person, such as in a podcast, like I'll admit, I'm not always the best. You can ask my parents. You can ask my girlfriend. I don't always listen the best. But when it comes to podcasting, I know it's like there's a certain level of I have to take everything out and just show up empty pretty much and just willing to ask questions. And I think that's just my philosophy on listening. And so far, it's worked so well.
And doesn't that make life more interesting because you get to hear so much good stuff?
Yeah. Everyone's interesting when you come in with nothing.
Amen. I love that.
Yeah. Last question is, where can people find you?
Okay. So originclear.com is our website, and you'll find out all about us and the cool things we do. If you check out our in the news section, you'll see that we were, last weekend we were on Newsmax with a coverage. And on Tuesday we were on Fox 5 in Atlanta, whatever, all that good stuff.
Nice.
Yeah, so strongly recommend just checking out Origin Clear. Of course, we're in Facebook as Origin Clear. I think that's a great place to go. Do sign up for my weekly briefing. Just if you go to originclear.com, you'll get an invitation to join it. It's a lot of fun, and we like to say we're the most transparent public company in America because every Thursday night I tell you what's going on, and that's pretty rare.
Yeah, that's pretty sweet. All right, Riggs, thanks for coming on the show. This was a super awesome interview. I was glad talking to you.
Armand, it's a pleasure, and let's check in 6 months or a year and see how we've both gone.
Yeah, we can even, someone suggested this, one of my previous guests, and I'm trying to do this more, is a year later doing a How Are They Doing Now episode, kind of like a catch-up.
I like that.
Yeah.
I'm all for that, so let's do it, and it's been such a pleasure, Armand. It's a great experience, because you get asked a lot of questions, and it actually makes you think, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, I'm glad.